knock it off.
God has used our unity to grow and change me. That's one of our models for, Elizabeth and I attend Berean Baptist Church in Atlanta, Georgia. And it used to be on our bulletin, it's like growing and changing together. And that's what God has been doing in my life. And also here at Yearty is using this to change me. This is, stepping out in front of people is a big step for me. And I've done it a few times. And God seems to keep working in that area in my life. So to get over my fear of standing in front of people. I teach a Sunday school class, but I teach boys, fifth and sixth grade boys. And occasionally I get the girls. And then the one big difference, if I had a room full of fifth and sixth graders, the boys would be over here, and the girls would be over here. Oil and water don't mix. They just do not want to sit with each other. But it's been a great learning for me, a great experience for me. I didn't talk about my sons. Well, I have three sons. Our oldest boy is Charlie. He is I'm a junior. He's a third. And he had the we were going to name him something different, but he was born on his granddaddy's birthday. And since I'm so he got the same name as his granddad, which is my name as well, too. And he's 27 years old. He's married. He's got a little granddaughter, Bethany Grace. She's about a little over a year and a half old now. Charlie's a teacher at Bob Jones Academy in Greenville. We have a set of twins also. They're 25 years old. Jonathan is a Christian school teacher at Killian Hill Christian School there, just outside the suburbs of Atlanta. And Christopher, who's been here, been with David, wherever he's at, and down in the south part of Spain. Well, they've actually been here a year as well. He is finishing up his last year of law school, and he'll be done soon. So, when Brother Andy asked me to speak this morning, I knew this is something that the Lord wanted me to do. And, of course, your mind runs, races through all sorts of stuff. What do I do? What do I say? So I went to my pastor, Pastor Dan Swett. I said, Pastor, this is what's going on. What do I talk about? So he says, what's in your hand? He said, simple as that. What is your hand? Tell him what's in your hand. Two meanings with that caught my attention. He had just had me recently speak in a men's breakfast. We have a men's breakfast during the school year once a month. And he had me speak about missions from a layman's perspective. What's in my hand? What are some of the skills and tools that I could use for serving the Lord? But also, what is that in thy hand? Does that ring a bell with any of you? Have you ever heard of that before? Is that a phrase you've heard? Where have you heard that? Where in the Bible is that found?
When God's talking to Moses.
At the burning bush, exactly. That's exactly. Let's. I'll start reading here in Exodus chapter 3, verses 2 through 4. And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. And Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. And when the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called unto him out of the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, here am I. You all remember the story of Moses. You remember what tribe he was born? Just a little trivia question. I don't have a dollar for you. He's a Levite. And he was born in what country? Egypt, yes. And during his time, there was a king of Egypt who did not remember Joseph. Remember Joseph and many years apart. And the king of Egypt was very concerned, very threatened by the Israeli population. And he was afraid that there was a war sometime that they would turn against them and fight against the Egyptians. They were becoming a mighty army. And the commandment was that all your male children were to be killed. Throw them in the river. And Moses' parents kept the child, I guess it was just about, I think 3 months, that's what's thinking, Maya, 3 months old. And they built a little basket, put him in the river. You remember the story. And then one day, Pharaoh's daughter is walking along the river, and she finds the child. And she adopts the child as her own. The commentary I was reading was saying that it's more likely that Pharaoh's daughter did not have any other children. So Moses was raised in the house of Pharaoh all those years. And you know, as he grew up one day, he knew about his heritage, his Jewish heritage, and he decided he'd rather be sided, we'll talk more about this later, site more with the Jewish people than he did with the Egyptians. And he decided he was going to do something about it. He saw the persecution against the Jewish people, and he was going to fix that problem, didn't he? How'd that work for him? You remember? What happened, Josh?
He killed an Egyptian.
He killed an Egyptian. And did the Jewish people get right behind him? No, they didn't. And next thing you know, he's running for his life, and he finds himself on the backside of the desert. His plans, his idea had failed. He spent 40 years on the backside of a no-name desert shepherding sheep. But it gave him a lot of opportunity for meditation with his God, learning about God, spending time in prayer. I think about David, all those times shepherding. Moses had 40 years to spend time with God. But after that 40 years, Moses had changed quite a bit. He no longer had the confidence in his ability that he had when he left Egypt. He saw himself as a failure, helpless, unworthy for God's service, unworthy to do anything to help the Jews out. 40 years early, he tried to save the Jews on his own strength. He was then full of confidence, but now he's full of self-doubt. He was courageous. He went and fought and killed an Egyptian, but now he's full of fear. He thought he could conquer, but now he's in fear of being conquered himself. He was willing then, but he wasn't ready. But now, 40 years later, he's ready, but he's not willing. Interesting. Moses raised the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He benefited from all the privileges of growing up in Egyptian royalty. From growing up in the palace, the foods he ate, probably the finest in foods, the education. From a schooling and university degree, he probably had the finest in educations that the Egyptians had to offer. He grew up an Egyptian. He looked like an Egyptian. He acted like an Egyptian. He thought like an Egyptian. In most everything except that one part about the Jewish part. For all practical purposes, Moses was an Egyptian. Now, all that is gone. He lives on the backside of a forsaken desert, shepherding sheep. You remember the story of Joseph. How the Egyptians think about it, shepherds? They were an abomination. Moses, for most practical purposes, he's an Egyptian. But now he's shepherding sheep. The worst thing that an Egyptian young man could ever consider doing. And now he's a shepherd of sheep. And to make matters worse, they're not even his sheep. They're his father-in-law's sheep. He doesn't even have anything. He has nothing to claim of his own. So now after a major lesson, a 40-year lesson in humility, boy, that's unbelievable. 40 years learning humility, God reveals himself to Moses. Chapter 4, verse 2 says, "And the Lord said unto him, What is that in thine hand? What is that in thine hand?" When God asks what you have in your hand, he has a purpose. He wants to use what's in your hand for his service. If God's work through Moses would continue, he needs what's in Moses' hand. He must have what's in Moses' hand. If God was going to show a miracle to Moses, he needs what's in Moses' hand. And what was in his hand? That rod, that staff, that shepherd's staff. If we're going to do anything for God, God must have what's in our hand as well. If we're unwilling, we'll hinder the work of God. We'll hinder our growth of faith. So, Moses simply answered in verse 2, a rod. Now, I had to get a rod for this. So I went to the rod store. When I was thinking about this lesson, I was concerned that I was going to find a wimpy rod. I was thinking, well, the sheep were probably disappointed in my rod. But I'm pretty pleased with my rod. I like it. We went down, driving down the road, and there was a lot of rods to choose from. Now, for Moses, there's nothing special about his rod. There was no fancy engravings in it. It was a tool to fight off predators, a tool to guide the sheep, a tool perhaps to a tool to rescue him. I was looking at mine. Mine's got a few more features. I mean, I'm thinking, oh, I got a coat rack up here. I got a back scratcher. I have a navigation system. Really, I do. You know, I'm a pilot. I fly airplanes, so we have
GPS, global positioning systems. I have IMS, inertial navigation systems. This has an MPS system on it. I will never get lost in the desert. You know what I'm talking about? There it is. It's got moss on it. We're in the northern hemisphere, so moss grows on which side of a tree?
North.
North side of a tree. There you go. I will never get lost. I always know where north is. You don't like that idea?
Does it stand for moss positioning system?
Yeah. Moss positioning system. If I showed up my airplane this one day, would you have confidence in me?
No.
Yeah. But anyhow, pretty good idea. So, anyhow, for Moses, though, his rod wasn't much to look at, nothing special about it. But God saw a lot in the rod of Moses. You know, in a few short verses, what's God going to do with that rod?
Turn it into a serpent.
Wouldn't that be cool this morning? We could lay it right here.
That would be cool.
Heads or tails?
Heads or tails?
That would be neat. That would really be cool this morning. Now, you got to be thankful. This is not my first rod. I had another one. And I didn't want to get inside the vehicle. I didn't drag this one. I was dragging it alongside the road. It was on the other side of the creek where you get that big hill. I didn't think I could make it up a hill. See, my other rod was longer than my car. Can anyone say, anaconda? Or as Pastor Ken was talking today, was it Mumba? Mumba, you said the other day?
Mamba.
Yeah.
Like Mamba.
I don't know if I'd be happy to have a Mumba in here this morning or an anaconda, but it was bigger than my car. I thought that was pretty cool. So, anyhow. But, get back to my lesson here. So, Moses saw nothing special in this rod, but God did. When it was given to God, it would do much. As we mentioned before, God used it to turn into the snakes. Snake in Moses' presence here by the burning bush, but later in Pharaoh's presence. Later on, Moses' rod would initiate a lot of the plagues in Egypt. It would part the Red Sea. It would strike the rock, and the water would come forth. Moses, you remember the story, held it over his head, fought against the Amalekites. His hands were propped, he sat on a rock, his hands were propped up, and gave delivery with the Amalekites. Sometimes it's referred to as Aaron's rod, but it was Moses' rod. Later on, it was placed in the temple, and what happened? It left overnight in the temple. What happened? Do you remember to it? It what? It budded and blossomed, had almonds on it. All with Moses' rod. God likes to use insignificant things sometimes. Can you think of some small things that, in man's purposes, insignificant, God used a great deal in the Bible? Can you give me some examples? Think of one. There's a bunch of them. There's lots of them. How about Gideon? Had a pitcher, a torch, a trumpet to bring delivery over the Midianites. That was pretty good, wasn't it? Now we got, get some of the other one. Ehud. You know who Ehud was? What did he have? A single dagger. That's all he had, a single dagger. Brought delivery to the children of Israel. Shamgar had an ox goad. David had a sling. There was a little boy's lunch that God did a lot with, didn't he? How about the widow? She had two mites. God did a lot with little things. So, turn the page here. So, what is in thy hand? I got a couple of verses to read. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 11 and 12. And it gave some apostles and some prophets and some evangelists and some pastors and teachers for the perfecting of the saints, for the work of the ministry, for the edifying of the body of Christ. And once you find it, I'm going to switch to 1 Corinthians 12:28. And God had set some in the church, first apostles, secondary prophets, thirdly teachers, after that miracles, then gifts of healings, helps, remember that word, governments, and diversity of tongues. As Mr. Bell talked about yesterday, we've got many seniors, soon you'll be seniors, you're going off to college next year.
You've got goals and ambitions. Many of you here will become missionaries, pastors, teachers. You'll be used for unlimited. You have so much potential in you. There's so many things God's going to do with you. But what about right today? What are we going on today? I want to focus on that word helps. It's stuck right in there. Everybody knows the missionaries and all the other definitions for all the items there. But the word helps is kind of vague. To helps is to offer assistance. Offer assistance doing what? It doesn't say. Where? It doesn't say. To whom? Again, it doesn't say. No definition, no detail. It's plural. It means it's not just one item. It's many things. It's left to the reader to define. Helps could be almost anything. Building, teaching, music. You got a lot of music talent here. Witnessing, of course. That should be all of ours. Cooking or cleaning. Talking to somebody. Listening to somebody. Somebody just needs someone to listen to them. Caring, being a friend, or just being there for somebody. That all, and you probably could add to that list of helps. It doesn't say where helps are supposed to be applied. The ministry helps varies in its functions as people vary. Most importantly, none of us can excuse us from the ministry of helps. So, what is in thy hand? Opportunity. First verse I'll read, Galatians 6:10. As we have therefore opportunity, let us do good unto all men, especially unto them who are of the household of faith. Most of the great things done for God are not results of grand plans. They usually grow from the initiative taken by Christians when they see a need or a problem that has arisen. It doesn't take a revelation from God or a directive from a leader to respond to a challenge or to a crisis. God wants his people to be active rather than passive, responding in whatever way they can to the needs of those that they meet. Do whatever you can to meet the needs in front of you than rather waiting for a perfect time. Proverbs 3:27-28. Withhold not good from them to whom it is due, when it is in the power of thy hand to do it. Say not unto thy neighbor, go and come again tomorrow. I will give, and when thou hast it by thee. There was an English politician named Edmund Burke. He had a famous quote back in the 18th century. And the quote was, no one ever made a greater mistake than he who did nothing because he could only do a little. Let me say it again. No one ever made a greater mistake than he who did nothing because he could only do a little. We sometimes face the temptation to wait until we can do something more for God. In your situation, maybe waiting until we got that pastorate degree, that college degree, that doctorate, that seminary training before we actually did something for God. God wants us working for now. In my I get my notes here, I say rabbit trail. In my Sunday school class, I got my boys for 2 years, fifth and sixth grade, then they go off to the teen department. And before they leave my class, I say something like this. I said, your faith, I believe most of my boys are saved. And it says, your faith, your religion needs to be yours, not your parents, not your grandparents. You need to own it for yourself. I understand with children, their parents bring them to church, the parents are responsible to make sure they're there on time. I want them to own their faith themselves. And so to get out in the world and say, well, this is what my mom would do. But what can you do today? What would you do? I was thinking of an illustration. I first saw it. As you know, I'm a pilot. And when a person learns how to fly, they get with an instructor, and it starts with bookwork. And we start learning about the parts of an airplane, the aerodynamics, the rules of the road, rules of flying, how an airplane works, how lift is created, how an airplane flies. And one day we step out in an airplane with an instructor, and we take all that classroom time, and we start applying it to an airplane. And we learn how to
make turns and how to climb and how to descend. And then we start maybe perhaps doing some emergency procedures, and we learn how to take off and land and work through all this stuff, and you work on proficiency. And then one day, the instructor says, pull over beside that building over there and keep the engine running. And he unbuckles the seatbelt and opens the door, and he steps out. And he says, I want you to take the airplane around the pattern by yourself. At first solo. And he turns and walks away and goes. And your heart's bump. And you're a little nervous. You knew this day was going to come, but not today. You know? And so you push the power up and you taxi out to the end of the runway, and you're sitting there and you're frightened, you're scared. And you line up with the runway, and you, all right, you do your pre-flight checks, you check your engine, you look at your controls, and they're all moving all over the airplane. And now it's time. You look down at the end of the runway, and there's nobody there, and it's time for you, and you push the power up, and the airplane starts lunging forward, accelerating speed. And it just leaps off the ground. We don't have the weight of the instructor, and it just jumps off the ground, and you're going up. It really does. It does. You get that 200 pounds out of there, and it just and you're climbing up like, oh! You've done it before. You've been doing it with an instructor. And you climb up there, and you level off top, and you pull back, and you get to 800 feet, and throttle back. And you look around, and, oh, this is kind of nice up here. And you look around, and you make a crosswind leg, and you turn around, and, wow, it's kind of pretty up here. And you look over here, and the seat's still empty. as if it would magically reappear. You know, you look down the runway, and the airport's getting smaller and smaller. And you start breathing again, and you turn downwind leg, and you're flying around, and you go back to your training. Touchdown point, okay, pull the throttle back. Give me a glide speed, okay. There's the road I turn at, turn across the road. Okay, line up with the runway. Here comes the runway. Pull the power back flare. Beep, beep. And you get on the ground, and I did it. I did it by myself. And you taxi back, and you got a little swagger to your step. I did it. I think in the Lord's work, we have a first solo sometimes. Many first solos, actually. I mean, you have many solos. I mean, in flying, the first time you fly an airplane. But then there'll be a solo, perhaps, nighttime. Maybe there'll be a solo cross-country. And solo doing something else. And a solo on a different type of aircraft. The same as in the Lord's world. You've had an instructor for all these years. Your parents. And you're working with that instructor. And one day, you're going to go off to college as seniors. You're going to go off without them. Without that instructor. And as being a parent of, well, college kids, they're all out of school now, almost out of school, you want to see your children make right decisions. You want to see them make decisions for themselves. And you send them off to school. Our boys all went to Bob Jones. But even still, they know Bob Jones is a Christian school, and they have their program, and everything's kind of formatted. But you want to see your boys, your children, make decisions for themselves. You want to see them take responsibility for themselves. I know they're going to be in chapel service. I know they're going to be, at that time they had the morning, Sunday morning church services. I know they'll be in Bible classes. But you want to see them pick up the responsibility. And for our boys, they attended a local church. And next thing we hear, through the grapevine, they saw a need. They got involved in the water programs. Oh, they got involved with the orchestra. We didn't push them to do that. That was the first solo for them. And that was, to me, that was a big deal for them. For us, for my wife and I, to see our children picking up the responsibility and doing that. Doing what they've been trained to do. Not being told, but making that choice, that first solo, to make those decisions on their own. And that was an exciting time for us. Let's look at some other first solos in the Bible. How about Abraham? Hebrews 11:8 says, by faith, Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should have to receive from inheritance, obeyed and he went out, not knowing whither he went. He chose to believe God and follow God. Moses. We just talked about Moses. Again, in Hebrews chapter 11, the great hall of faith. By faith, Moses, when he was come to years, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. I left this out. Let me interject here. It's believed that Pharaoh's daughter didn't have any other children. Moses would have been in line for the kingship. Possibly. Maybe not first in line, but he would have been in line. He gave all that up. Choosing rather to suffer the affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season. Esteeming the reproach of Christ greater than the riches treasures in Egypt, for in respect and to the recompense of the reward. Joseph. Joseph was, obviously, his father gave him a coat of many colors, but he was at home. Joseph goes off. His university, his schooling and training wasn't what we would have ever desired. I don't think Bob Jones is like that. I can't compare Joseph's training with Bob Jones' training, but he was in Potiphar's house. What could he do in Potiphar? He could sat there and complain and upset, I don't deserve to be here. But it says here in Genesis 29, 2 and 3, and the Lord was with Joseph, and he was a prosperous man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Lord was with him, and the Lord made all that he did prosper in his hand. Joseph shows, I'm going to please God. I'm here where I don't want to be here. This is, I don't deserve to be here. I was wrongly sent here, but I'm going to do the best I can. I'm going to choose to fulfill my responsibilities to the best of my ability. I'm going to honor God. And yeah, he did. I had a personal testimony. Allow me to give my whole salvation testimony. My parents are not saved. Still not today. I grew up in a Methodist family. But to the grace of God, my parents weren't comfortable with the public school system in South Florida. I grew up in South Florida. They were concerned about it. There was a lot of violence and a lot of problems. So they sent me to a Christian school. And both my brother and I went to a Christian school. And Christian school was run by an independent Baptist church. And I started there when I was in my sixth grade. And attended there many years. My father and mother warned me going there, don't let them deceive you. This is deception the other way around. This is backwards deception. Don't let them trick you into this quote-unquote getting saved, quote-unquote getting salvation. And I was at this church at this school for quite a long time. I was there from sixth grade through eight and a half to halfway through my eighth grade. The people who had been there kind of almost fell in the steps of my parents' warning. They were really high pressure. You need to get saved. Yelling at, like Pastor Kim was talking about, you're going to hell, you're going to get saved. And that just drove me away, scared me away. And then one day, we got a new pastor, and he brought in a new youth pastor, and it was different. This youth pastor cared for me. He showed concern for me. I've got this verse. Let me read this verse here. I was telling my testimony to somebody else, and someone pointed out this verse for me. In Jude 22 and 23, you probably have heard this before. And others saved with fear, pulling them out of the fire, hating even the garments spotted by the flesh. Now, see, back up again. And some have compassion, making a difference, and others saved with fear, pulling them out of the fire, hating even the garments spotted by flesh. I wasn't one that responded to the yelling and being driven, but I did respond to someone who cared. Mr. Metcalf was my youth pastor. He was also my baseball coach. And he showed he cared for me. And he called me in his office one day, and he told me how he cared for me. And about halfway through, actually December 13th, in the middle of my ninth grade year, he called me in his office and showed how he was concerned for my salvation. And I had been listening to him preach for about, in chapel service for almost a year. I got to the point that I knew I needed to get saved. I was just fearful. Afraid of what my parents might say, afraid of what my peers might say. He called me in his office, and we were one-on-one. None of them were there, and I accepted Jesus Christ as my personal Savior when I was 14 years old, middle of ninth grade. And that's when I was saved. About end of my 11th grade, Mr. Metcalf left the school, and he went to another ministry, and the school changed a lot. Unpleasant situation. My senior year at the school, there was a disagreement. There was an accusation, and the rift, the gulf got greater, and it got bigger. And we graduated my senior year at my Christian school. The church split, and one church became two churches. Very angry people, upset one another. I was 17 years old, and I had to make a choice on which half of the church I was going to align myself with. I had friends on both sides. Kind of an unusual decision for 17 years old. So I make a decision. And for a couple months, things were going okay. And then one day I pulled in the church parking lot. And the pastor's in the parking lot beating all the cars coming in. And his words were, "We're not having church today. I'm stepping down. We're closing the church." I'm 17 years old. And my parents warned me about it. Now, apparently, back up. My parents were not at all thrilled that I left the Methodist Church and became a Baptist. What was I going to do at 17 years old? I did not want to go home early because my parents were against or asking questions. So I drove around. I'm living in South Florida. What do people do in South Florida? It's summertime. You got the beach. They're going to the beach. I'm watching people loading up their golf clubs, their tennis rackets, going to the park, going to the beach. And I actually did that for a couple weeks. I dressed like I was going to church, didn't tell my parents a thing, and I drive. I would just sit in the park and watch people. And the thought occurred to me, that looked almost nice. They seemed to have no worries. They seemed to have no struggles as they went and did their own business. And I almost desired to have that no stress. I'd just been through a traumatic situation with a church split, and I didn't know which way to go. It occurred to me during those couple weeks that I was quote unquote, I was accountable to no one. No one knew if I was in church. No one cared if I was in church. I know that's not true, and you know why it's not true. And one day, I was driving down the road on a Sunday, God turned the lights on, and he revealed to me that he hadn't changed. The truth had not changed. The people had failed me, but God had not.
Amen.
He had not failed me. I got some verses to go along with that. 2 Timothy 1:12, the second part. "For I know whom I have believed, and am persuaded that he is able to keep that which I've committed unto him against that day." I committed to him that December 13th, my middle of ninth grade year, the salvation of my soul. And you know what? That hadn't changed. The truth, the gospel, had not changed. My soul was still in his hand, and he was still taking care of me. You've seen this verse at the whiles, but continue thou. 2 Timothy 3:14 and 15. "But continue thou in things which thou hast learned and assured of, knowing of whom thou hast learned them, and that from a child thou hast known the Holy Scriptures, which are able to make thee wise in salvation through faith which is in Christ Jesus." Those things that I learned in those few years of Christian school are still the truth. And God taught me those things. And I struggled for a few years, but I knew that I had to be in church. And that's what I did. And I had some difficult questions to answer by my parents. But I made a choice that, to the best of my ability and the best of the knowledge I had, I was going to serve the Lord and be in church and do what I had to do. Later on, I transferred to colleges, and the Lord worked it out. I had a Christian roommate. And later on, while I was in college, we found us in a Christian church, and I found my wife at a church, and where the Lord led me to many years later. So, we talked about opportunity. How about ability? You've heard the old cliche, the best ability is availability. And that really is true. Just getting somebody to be there, to do those little things, to help out. Your seniors going to college next year, one day you're going to be missionaries, pastors, evangelists, You're going to be mighty men of God, mighty women of God. But what about now? You have the opportunity to still serve God with what's in your hand right now. You just have to use your availability. We joined Berean Baptist Church back when the children were small. Berean Baptist Church built a new auditorium just as we had joined the church. And they had new property, and there was a faithful man back in time named Don Miller. He was a World War II Korean War vet, and he took on himself to do to landscape the yard, plant the trees and the shrubbery. And I was about 26 years old at the time or something like that. What was in my hand at that time? When I was growing up in South Florida, for my job, I mowed grass. Grass grows a lot in South Florida. Great summer job. Pays well. Flexible hours. Every week you can go out and cut somebody's grass. And it paid well. I enjoyed that. So I had a lawnmower. I knew how to mow grass. So I approached him and says, "Can I help?" That was what was in my hand. I know it seems insignificant. But that's what God used me as a stepping stone. That was my first step. And God had me cutting grass. So I stretched water hoses to water trees and cut grass all through the summer, and I started doing things like that. One day, Pastor said, "I need somebody to build some shelves in this closet." Okay, well, I've never done anything like that before. I'll try. So I volunteered. It was a walk-in closet. It probably took me a month to figure out how I'm going to build shelves in a walk-in closet. I had no idea what I was doing. And being from an aeronautical engineering degree, I went a little heavy on the structure. It was built, you could climb up on them. You could climb up on them. And they were there until just, maybe they were up there for many, many years. They finally took them down last year. But they survived. Well, I built the shelves, and then I built something else. And then I built something else. Guy, like, "Hey, you helped build this wall unit for the nursery, or build this." And and my project got a little more complicated, a little bit more polished, a little more sophisticated. God was giving me a little chance to step up and grow and do different things. And yeah, that's in the building area. And then so one day he says, "We need somebody to help with a 5th and 6th grade Sunday school class." Oh, that was scary. Those kids are so scary looking. You know? I was frightened to get in front of those 5th and 6th grade boys. I mean, what are they going to do to me? I weighed more than 3 of them, I guess. But I stepped in and started teaching those 5th and 6th grade boys. And we teach Old Testament Bible characters. I have 12 characters we teach, and it's really good now. I've really gotten to enjoy it with Old Testament Bible characters. You get to kill a lot of people. You get to kill them in very creative, colorful ways, and that's a lot of fun. So I mean, you think about King Ahab. I mean, a random arrow. You got, oh, the guys love this. Jezebel in her first flying lesson. I think a little bit more flap and a lot more throttle, and maybe she could have pulled out. King Jehoram. You know, remember Jehu? You know, oh, I like that. That was pretty cool. And you kind of build up that creaking of that arrow, that bow with Jehu's hand shooting that. The captain in his 50. We just did that a couple weeks ago. I like doing that. You know. "If I be a man of God, let fire come down and consume you and your 50. Whoosh. You know? That's fun. Guys like that. So the girls, occasionally I get the girls in the class and they look at me like, "You're a boys' Sunday school teacher." Yuck. In a chance of doing many mission trips, we've had all kinds of unique examples. We were here on a mission trip, 3 or 4 years ago. We were doing we did the two warehouses up at the top of the hill, and we were doing trim. We were doing the staircase and the trim work downstairs. Have you noticed in the trim work the yellow logo? Do you know what that is? It's the Basque logo. the Basque logo. It's four provinces, three here in Spain and one in France, the Basque logo. We were trimming out the woodwork. I had this big empty spot. It just looked blank and empty, and what are we gonna do with this? And we could put a cross. Put a cross there. I put my initials on there. And I was sitting at breakfast one morning down in the dining room, and Brother Randy was down there, and he had his keychain out, and he put it on the table. On his keychain, he had a key ring, and on the key ring, he had a little decorative Basque logo. And I just saw that. Oh, that's great. And I said, how can I make this work? We had a couple in our church that was on that team. They're very detailed people, and they're artists. I approached them. I said, you see this logo? I need you to make a paper one about this big. And they've got a shadow drawing, and they traced it all out, and they drew this whole thing. And we turned into a stencil, and we routed the whole thing out, and that's why we got that whole thing. That was in their hand. Those artists. Brother Andy was talking about the artist who painted this. You know, they just, that was in their hand. They painted these signs. We had, you saw the paintings at church. Brother Andy was working with a man named Chuck Dix. I was with Chuck Dix in Mexico back in 2000, 2001. And we'd go around different towns and have different meetings. And we would show a movie and a video. Well, as things would happen sometimes, things don't always work perfectly. The light bulb in the video projector burned out. And now you got all these people sitting there. Now what are you going to do? We're going to show a Spanish video. So Mr. Dick says, you got any chalk? You got any paper? Yeah. Yeah. So they get a stencil up, or a, what's the tripod called?
Easel.
Easel. Thank you. You got an easel up there with the paper up there. He makes a Bible chalk drawing. One, he had a cross up there with a setting sun, a cross on a hill with all the rocks down there. And he colored it just, and it was with Bible verses, and people would, the pastor would talk about a Bible verse and read some verses as he's making this drawing. And one of them had an empty tomb with a sunrise coming up. And that was in his hand. It was fantastic. It captured the people. We were there the next year and doing door-to-door and opened the door. And there was one of the chalk drawings from the previous year. They had put it up in the living room. You know, God, you never know what God's going to use at various different times. Let's see what else I got. Oh, back to building. Back to building. Pastor asked, we built a second auditorium, and says, I would really like for somebody to build a new pulpit for our church. And I'm thinking, uh-oh. You know, I built things in closets, and things in small classrooms. And he said, I really would like for somebody to build a new pulpit for our church auditorium. And I talked to Pastor. I said, Pastor, I've never built anything like that before. Let me give it about a week to think about it. Another older man says, I don't have much building skills, but I'd like to help you. His name is Martin Ballou. And we sat down, we looked at some catalogs and what we wanted to look like. And we got, it took us the better part of a year and a half. But we built a new pulpit and a communion table and a little Bible, a little small pulpit rolls away, and a little Bible stand. Only pulpit that has landing gear. I've got retractable landing gear in my pulpit. So it was kind of, I was thinking about it. It's pretty good size. You know, the pulpit is, it's wide on the sides, it's got oak on top with inlaid walnut, but it got to be pretty heavy. Again, the engineering side, I tend to overbuild things sometimes. It weighed 250 pounds. So I mean, I was gonna make a separate dolly, but the dolly would never be around. And if somebody tries to pick up this thing, it's about half the weight of a piano. So I installed some wheels in it, and you got some cranks in it. You just crank it and just move this off the ground and you roll it away. So retractable landing gear. So that was pretty cool. So it's a little bit better. So well, and then we built another one of the small pulpits for our deaf ministry. And then Brother Andy was at our church 2 years ago, and he says, Chuck, he says, I need a new pulpit. Okay. And I said, boy, it'd be nice if we could build it here in Atlanta, because I've got all my tools and my garage I can work in. And he said, I pointed to that smaller pulpit we have. I said, how about one like that? He goes, oh, that'd be just fine. So now we're going to think, okay, we build this here. How are we going to get it over there? So we built a pulpit that we could disassemble and put in suitcases. And And that's how the pulpit sitting in the church auditorium got there. It looks very similar to what we have in our own church. And they got two of the guys to help me, and we got it fit in three suitcases, less than 50 pounds apiece. We got it over here and assembled the thing. So now, two of the suitcases got lost and rerouted to Amsterdam, which was, but they all made it there. So it was pretty cool. So what I'm saying, God will provide opportunities. Use what is in your hand. Reward. 1 Corinthians 3:8. And every man shall receive his own reward according to his own labor. Building and missionary products, projects that we've been involved today. Of course, you've seen a lot of stuff at Yearty. I've done some work, do a lot of work in the Dominican Republic. God, I didn't, fearful teaching the Sunday school class. I was really fearful to go on that first mission trip. Berean Baptist Church is a very mission-minded church. They had teams going every year. And pastor would take a sign-up list and put it in the foyer and says, "Hi, Mrs. Sweat, go put this in the foyer." She announced during the service, they put it up there. I knew if I delayed, if I just talked to somebody and delayed, the list, the whole front list would be filled out and there'd be names in the back. And you go, "Oh, that's too bad. I guess I can't go on the trip this year." And I did that for a couple of years. And, you know, all my conscience, my heart was just, I knew I needed to be going on a trip. But I was so afraid. I was afraid to go on a trip. What was I afraid of? Afraid of the missionaries. You know? Maybe the missionary kids. You know, they're great godly people. Great pillars of the faith. And I'm not. And I wasn't. And I was afraid that I'd get found out. That I'm not the Christian I should be. And I was afraid to go on these trips. And oh, my conscience bothered me. And one day, my pastor was making a survey trip. He used to organize all the trips. And he was going to Mexico by himself, a little state of Sinaloa. And Holy Spirit kept saying, "Ask him if you can go. Ask him if you can go." And so I kind of cowardly walked up to Pastor Sweat. "Pastor, are you going to Mexico in a few weeks?" "Yes, I am," he said. "And, can I go with you?" Hoping he would say, "No, I've got it covered." No, he said yes. Oh, he said yes. And I went with him. I had nothing to offer. I think my hands were empty at that time. What is in my hand? But God wanted me to show that, yes, I could go on a mission trip. And I did. And I found out that the missionary people and the missionary kids weren't that odd. They weren't that strange. And they were fun. I had a good time. And I thought, I can do this. And that was back in 2000. And so every year, I've been doing more and more mission work. And now, I've got the Lord has had me step out further and further. So now I'm organizing my own trips and working on more trips. And I find that very rewarding to bring people, especially to our yearly. Brother Andy does a great job with social media, putting pictures and notes and messages. And everybody gets the bug. Get bit by the bug and says, I want to come. Well, my wife and I decided we could be enablers, enabling people to come to the mission field. And we've done taking some people. We took some people last year to the Dominican Republic as well. And that's all people need sometimes. Just need a little, "Won't you come with me?" And just come along with me, and I'll help make everything possible, and I'll take care of you on this trip. And I'll make sure, and I can't make sure you're going to be sick. I got sick this week. But we'll make sure that you're taken care of and you have a good time, and we'll find good lodging, a good place to stay, and you'll get to learn a lot about the ministry. So what is in thy hand? What is in your hands? Next year, some of you are going to be on a college campus, and you're going to have an opportunity to see what does God want in your hand to use for him. What has the Lord given to you that you could use for him? It may be something that you haven't considered yet. Are there any?
Thanks. That was excellent.